From deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe, this is VSI Radio International. Autumn is a second spring when every leaf is a flower. Turning another leaf as autumn begins, this is the voice of the sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. Another summer is coming to an end, and it's time to do a little housekeeping around here before carrying on much further. It's interesting to see the kind of response the program has been getting. I really did not know what to expect at first, so I simply left it up to listeners, who were so inclined, to send feedback by email, and then I just waited to see what I'd get. I've become acquainted with some of the most articulate and intelligent people from all over North America, and I'm always delighted to receive emails from them. Some of the emails I get offer arguments and points of view that have really kept me on my toes, and I appreciate that. Both agreement and disagreement are what helped me to improve the program. So far, I have yet to receive any truly stupid emails from anyone. I suppose I might be inviting some now by pointing out that fact. Well, so be it. But certainly the caliber of the average VSI listener tends to be very high, and I'm very proud of that. Now, I'm not surprised. It confirms what I've suspected all along, namely that the shortwave listening culture is, in general, far more cerebral and cultivated than the mainstream. By no means does every listener see eye to eye with me on everything, but the arguments are always well thought out and on topic, and best of all, it never gets personal. Light years away from the insipid rudeness found on Facebook and in YouTube comment threads, even the quality of dissent found in the shortwave radio culture is of higher caliber than that found outside of it. As it turns out, three distinct categories of VSI listeners have emerged. There is a solid core of regular listeners who write after just about every episode and offer detailed feedback and opinions about the topics discussed. This group tends also to suggest other topics for discussion, and indeed are very often the inspiration behind subsequent programs. Then there's a second group of listeners who respond from time to time just to check in to confirm that they're listening and give reception reports and indicate the locations from which they're writing and how well the signal is propagating. Many such listeners are quite regular as well. Then the third group consists of new listeners, or at least those writing into the program for the first time. Each week, the VSI email inbox has a few new names popping up, offering everything from simple but useful reception reports to kind praise, to constructive criticism, to new and interesting information and links, to complete essays. During the last mailbag session, you may remember a new contributor, Michael from Ohio. In his first email to VSI, he expressed a personal interest in the Middle East history and current affairs and asked me if I'd be addressing the Arab-Israeli conflict on the show, which I answered in saying that I would likely not be bringing up that issue on VSI. Well, Michael wrote in again 2 days after that episode aired with a very intelligent and passionate email. In it, he provided a long list of questions he wanted me to answer on the program and other points he wanted me personally to comment on the air, as he felt the matters raised were very urgent and worthy of discussion. And I agree they are, but I think, Michael, if you're listening now, that you're not going about it in the right way. When I first began producing VSI Radio International, I was having so much fun that I would very often, perhaps once in each episode, encourage other people to contact WBCQ and to start producing and broadcasting programs of their very own. I certainly do still encourage those interested to go ahead and do so, and I'm still having lots of fun. But the reason I've stopped saying that is simply because I realize just how much work is involved in putting together a show. Even one of such a straightforward format as a one-hour monologue weekly. It takes a lot of passion and dedication, and not everyone would keep up. Now, I don't mean this in any sarcastic way, but rather quite literally, Michael. Michael in Ohio, if you're listening, you really do need to get in touch with WBCQ and get yourself onto the air if you want the matters you brought up in your email discussed. I read your email carefully, and yes, in just about every respect, I'm on board with what you're thinking, your way of thinking. You have an important message that I agree is not getting out via the mainstream media, and you put forth your arguments very eloquently. However, I could not possibly read your email on the air and make the comments you want me to make to the listening audience. The prepared monologues for VSI, in those cases where the entire episode is scripted, such as in the Radio Nord specials and in many of the episodes from season one, run 20 pages typed double-spaced. There are some that have been about 25 pages, but then I'm struggling to squeeze it all in and throw a couple of short tunes in for the musical interludes. Now, I printed out and saved Michael's email, as it was a very good one, and God bless him, but Michael's email turned out to be 41 pages long. It would take me 2 episodes just to read his emails, let alone comment on all the things he wanted me to comment. And I don't want to discourage his or anyone else's feedback. I do read and acknowledge all the email I receive, and at times, that alone can take an entire day to do. As much as I enjoy reading what listeners have to write, I cannot promise to reply and offer comment on every detail, and I certainly do not promise to bring it up on the broadcast. Now, I will give Michael in Ohio the benefit of the doubt and presume that he did not hear the previous mailbag session in which I answered his first email, because if I were not to give him that benefit, I would actually have to be rather annoyed with him, in that in his 41-page email and the comments he wanted me to address all concerned the Arab-Israeli conflict, the very thing I quite clearly stated I would not be addressing on VSI. So if you're listening, Michael, in Ohio, I think it's really up to you to take the argument forward. You want to offer a balance to all the Israel bashing in the media? I welcome that, but you need to take the responsibility of taking to the airwaves yourself and opening yourself up to feedback and criticism, and be prepared to face the argument that many would make, that the mainstream media has a strong pro-Israel bias. The Middle East is clearly your, well, I was about to say hobby horse. I don't mean to minimize it. I know what you have to say is important, but you need to be the one to say it directly and not vicariously through another man's radio program. That said, as it ends up, I might touch upon one thing you mentioned, at least in an indirect way, but only because it happens to coincide, albeit tangentially, with some feedback that I received from another listener responding to the issues raised in a previous broadcast. But first, let's take a break for some music.
Oh, myself believe it. This night will never go.
Next loose end up with which to tie, thank you Winston Churchill, concerns some business raised by a very loyal listener and frequent contributor. Indeed, regular listeners will recognize the name, listener Fred in Ottawa. He himself is almost a feature of this program. As a rule, Fred offers me lots of compelling material to ponder, far more than I could possibly address on the show, but one thing he picked up on was the episode concerning the politics of name-calling. At present, one of the more common ways of stifling debate is to accuse someone of racism. Apparently, anyone opposed to Barack Obama's politics, no matter what rational arguments may be raised in criticism of the president's policies themselves, is simply racist, so we are told. Fred tells me something very interesting about the word racism. In his email, Fred writes, "If you look in an old English language dictionary, say before 1930 or so, you won't even find the word racist. The left is very good at coining new words and getting them picked up by the mass media and turning them into issues everyone ought to be obsessed with. Racisme appears in French in the magazine La Revue Blanche, Paris circa 1902. Racistov in Russian appears in Leon Trotsky's book The History of the Russian Revolution, circa 1930. Racism in the book The Coming American Fascism by L. Dennis was published in 1936. That was from Fred in Ottawa. It is interesting. I've not had time to look more into it. Surely there must have been a word for the phenomenon of racial bigotry. Indeed, perhaps simply racial bigotry. I'm not sure. We discussed this a few weeks ago. Whenever racism, literal racism, occurs, it is truly disgraceful, and most people, quite rightly, don't want to be labeled as racists. However, when Intellectually deficient or morally wretched people label all and sundry whose opinions differ from that of Obama as racist. They're only whitewashing the evils of racism when it actually occurs.
My sister went there on a Saturday, come dancing. All her boyfriends used to come and call. Why not come dancing? It's only natural. Another Saturday, another date. She would be ready, but she'd always make him wait. In the hallway, in anticipation. He didn't know the night would end up in frustration. He'd end up blowing all his wages for the week, or for a cuddle and a peck on the cheek. Come dancing, that's how they did it when I was just a kid. And when they said come dancing, my sister always did.
Silhouettes saying goodnight by the garden gate.
The day they knocked down the party, my sister stood and cried. The day they knocked down the party, part of my childhood died, just died. Sister's married and she lives on an estate. Her daughters go out, now it's her turn to wait. She knows they get away with things she never could. But if I asked her, I wonder if she would. Come dancing, come on sister, have yourself a ball. Don't be afraid to come dancing, it's only natural.
Listening to VSI Radio International. To get in touch with the program, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden, exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. Now, Fred also continues on to another label, which I avoided bringing up on this program generally, but I've changed my mind and I think it deserves comment on my part. It should not be so controversial or awkward, at least not among adults. And it would not be if, as Fred just pointed out, the media had not decided that it was a burning issue that all of us need to care about, and on which we all need to take a position. Fred continues in his email, "Homophobe is a more recent example. That is a more recent smear label than racist. It is ubiquitous now and implies exactly how any civilized person ought to think about the subject." End quote. Exactly. Here again we have the argument from intimidation. If people today still received some degree of classical education, then the very word would not have existed. Homophobia is syntactically absurd. It is not Greek for fear of sodomites or anything like that. The first part of the word is not derived from the Latin homo, meaning man, but rather the Greek homos, meaning the same. A phobia is an irrational fear, so homophobia is a fear of same. I suppose a literal homophobe would do things like wear two different colored socks for fear of having the same color. Of course, I do understand what is meant by homophobia. It suggests that those who disapprove of homosexuality suffer from some kind of syndrome or psychosis, that there's nothing at all abnormal about homosexuality, and that if you think there is, then you must have some kind of emotional or mental imbalance. Now, I'm not especially old yet, however, I do remember a time, quite clearly and well into my adulthood, that sensing an aversion to or disgust for such behavior was considered perfectly sane. What's changed? Is it enough, given an aggressive political lobby and sympathetic mass media, to change the facts of metaphysical reality? At least the word racism has a real meaning and describes a real evil, even if the word is far too liberally applied. Homophobia as a term is meaningless. There's no such thing as homophobia. There's nothing phobic about refraining from sodomy. Yes, indeed, I can say that I very strongly disapprove of the behavior of two people of the same sex, particularly two men, engaging in a mocking imitation of the human procreative act. However, keep in mind that when I say I disapprove of homosexuality, I also disapprove of smoking, overeating, excessive consumption of alcohol. That is, I separate the behavior from the person involved and strongly criticize the former while tolerating the latter. Certainly, we all have close friends and family members whom we like very much without necessarily liking everything they do. Adults are free to engage in any activity they want in a responsible manner that does not harm other people who do not want to be involved. It certainly is every man's individual right to engage in any such vice on these terms. That does not mean that everyone else has to approve. For instance, smokers will tell you themselves that they have a bad habit and tend not to encourage anyone else to pick it up. In fact, smoking as such is more and more being squeezed out of public life through it being banned in more and more public places and the practice altogether being discouraged through taxation and limitations on advertising, etc. I find it blatantly contrary that in the name of public health that we condemn smoking but bless sodomy. A responsible public health authority in any country would make clear that just like smoking, just like overeating, and just like excessive drinking, homosexuality is a public health menace. Now, just out of interest, if you're wondering why I turned to WBCQ in the United States to broadcast my message in the first place, well, here's why. Had this broadcast originated in Sweden, I would have just talked myself into a prison sentence. God bless you, Alan Weiner, and God bless America. Now, perhaps just a little more from Fred. He always sends such great stuff. Some things he writes I agree with wholeheartedly, and some things not. And I think he and I can just agree to disagree, which is fine. I prefer clarity to agreement. As long as both my listeners and I feel we've been given the chance to make our positions clear, it's perfectly okay to walk away not seeing eye to eye on a given matter. That's one of the great things about being on the, well, on the right, for want of a better word. Well, yes, I do have a better word, freedom. Those of us who love freedom are able to disagree, debate, discuss matters, and to gain from such dialogue. The left cannot. The left is a hermetically sealed jar in which the slightest air bubble of nonconformity will ruin their entire pickling of preconceived notions. That's why the left gets so emotional and distraught when faced with dissent. That's why people like me are never invited to their panel discussions or radio talk shows. The left claims to be open-minded in that it yearns to hear other opinions, but then goes into a frantic panic upon finding out that other opinions actually do exist. Now, picking up on how the media types coin their own labels for public consumption, Fred touches upon environmentalism. Quote Fred, "Sometimes they, the media, even change their coined words. When global warming started looking a bit shaky, then voila, climate change instead. The mass media, pretty much across the spectrum, jumped to get into line with the new term." End quote. I've always felt that environmentalism and the media make for very strange bedfellows, considering how quick the media are to jump on anyone making extraordinary claims which end up blowing up in their faces. You remember Harold Camping? Ever since the 1950s, he's been broadcasting on family radio, and he was a very well-known personality in the shortwave world, though largely unknown outside of it, and ignored by the mass media for decades. His Open Forum program was excellent in its scholarship. People from all over the United States, and sometimes beyond, would call in to his live call-in show with questions about the Bible and in interpretation. The man was quick with answers. I think that anyone, even non-religious people who are interested in the Bible as a book, would have found the program stimulating, devoid of all the frantic hallelujah ecstasy otherwise heard on shortwave. And that Camping continued well into his 90s with Open Forum. Well, my hat's off to him anyway. But when did the mainstream media finally pay Camping any attention? Only once the date was quickly approaching from when Camping had calculated that the end of the world would occur. Of course, this was very reckless of Camping, if not downright goofy. He'd always maintained the same claim: the Bible contains coded information that would be revealed to man as time goes on. As Camping reckoned, the world would end either in 1994 or 2011. 1994 came around and we were all still here, but Camping had always allowed for that. So then he was absolutely positively positive that the world would end in 2011. Well, 2011 came around and we were all still here. So Camping got it wrong once. While the media made Camping out to be goofy in predicting the end of the world, just what is it that the environmentalists tell us is looming if we do not embrace their agenda right away? The end of the world! How many times have the environmentalists been wrong in their goofy predictions? By now, 2013, there should have been no rainforest left in Brazil. By now, global cooling caused by CO2 emissions should have ushered in a new ice age. By now, we were supposed to be out of oil. The United States by now was supposed to be depleted of tin, nickel, zinc, and lead. In 1968, Paul Ehrlich stated that there would be a food shortage in the U.S. and that hundreds of millions would starve. Ehrlich is an interesting case in particular. He further claims that by the year 2000, the United Kingdom will be simply a small group of impoverished islands inhabited by some 70 million hungry people. If I were a gambler, I would take even money that England would not exist in the year 2000. Well, I suggest Ehrlich actually take up gambling, as his win-loss ratio in environmental fortune-telling show him to be dumber than chance. Blackjack offers better odds. I dare say that my fellow broadcaster, Brother Stair, has a better track record when it comes to predictions than do the environmentalists. Yet the environmentalists continue to be taken seriously by the mainstream media, in spite of being shown to be wrong time and time again. Now, those of you who tuned in last week will understand why. Why is it that the goofy end-of-the-world scenarios envisioned by environmentalists are not summarily relegated to the same dustbin as the camping chronology? Well, think of what the environmentalists say needs to be done in general. We humans need to make sacrifices, live with less material wealth, less comfort and convenience, and indeed less freedom, as new government powers need to be enacted and taxes raised. And while there's no evidence that such measures would have any meaningful effect, it does not matter, since at least we will have tried. Once again, the morality of altruism is showing its ugly head. Again, you're listening to VSI Radio International. To contact VSI, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. Another listener and frequent feedback author, who's certainly a household name among VS listeners as well, is Jim Tyner, who writes from upstate New York. In fact, last week's broadcast concerning the ethics of altruism was inspired by an email I had received from Jim immediately following the program on the politics of name-calling. Jim had this to say about the program in particular. Quote, Jim, I listened very closely and I must say you craft your argument quite expertly. As I followed along, I quite naturally found myself nodding in agreement, even during the section toward the end when you brought in Ayn Rand. I mention this only because I must confess I'm prejudiced when it comes to her philosophy, not because I've read it, but because of certain parts that have come to me as quotes or indirectly through reading other authors I've enjoyed who strongly reject her thought. Two hang-ups I have are her views on altruism in general and abortion in particular. Perhaps in a future show you can deal with the subject of altruism in more depth. I know you have spoken of it in passing several times in the past, but if I recall correctly, it's been in regard to the sort of state-coerced altruism, which I also reject. It has seemed to me that Ayn Rand goes much further in rejecting altruism. This has always struck me as belying an egotism that borders on monstrous. However, I'd like to hear what you have to say on the subject, as I'm inclined to believe from hearing you express your ideas over the past two seasons of VSIRI that you have read her work carefully, thoroughly, and critically. I'll stop for a moment. That was from Jim Tyner. Just stop for a second. Thank you for your kind words, Jim. And yes, I know that you've now listened to the program on altruism, and I think you have a better understanding of what I mean when I talk about it. As for Ayn Rand, all I can say is that whether you end up loving her or hating her, you only do her and yourself justice by reading what she wrote herself. I have yet to encounter a third-party evaluation of Rand's philosophy that even correctly identifies what she professed, let alone offer an adequate criticism or refutation. I do take a certain comfort in that. It's very much the case that Miss Rand was a tremendous influence on me when I was a younger man, and that such influence is certain to show through in my own work. Still, I don't share her entire philosophical position, and I don't want anyone to take my position as being identical to hers, both for her sake and my own. This is, after all, VSI, not the Ayn Rand hour. That said, she was an absolutely first-rate mind. Some of you have written to me to say that you could not really get into her work, either her fiction, such as the masterpiece Atlas Shrugged, or in any of her non-fiction essay compilations. I find that very unfortunate. So, Jim, while I appreciate that you realize that I've read her work carefully, thoughtfully, and critically, if you're ever inclined to get right down to the nuts and bolts of her philosophy, you should just go right to the source. Jim continues, "The music selections were also most enjoyable. I would just never hear selections like that in my normal course of listening. During the Olivia Newton-John number, the thought came to me that I really used to hate her songs back in the days when she was a staple on pop music radio. But this is actually pretty good, the none-too-subtle codependent relationship undertone to the lyrics notwithstanding." Just to clarify, the song played was A Little More Love. "I appreciated her voice and the instrumental track as I never did before. But again this time I really dug the Nordic number right at the end." And yes, Jim, that was in Swedish. "There must be some deep cultural resonance thing going on for me, because these pieces really grab me. Also, I've been meaning to ask you about the signature pieces at the beginning and end of every show. I find myself humming them at odd moments." Thank you very much for that, Jim, as always. Yes, it's a common question. The signature piece at the beginning of the program is an excerpt from Cat Stevens' Foreigner Suite, which is an 18-minute long song. The piece at the end of the show is called Gloria Victoria, or Glory Victory, of course, by the late American composer Joseph Harnell. I believe that composition appeared once and only once at the end of one episode of the science fiction miniseries V from 1983, though I'm not certain. Perhaps someone else knows. And Jim, yes, I'm very glad you've been appreciating the Nordic music selections. Many people have been. Quite often I will throw in a few of the better songs in Swedish, Norwegian, and Icelandic. I haven't played a Danish song yet, but I should try and find a good one soon. So for now, I'd like to treat you to the voice of a classic Swedish jazz singer with a voice like butter, Monica Zetterlund, singing Sakta vi går genom stan, or Slowly We Walk Through Town. And this is for you, Jim.
När mitt Stockholm är grönt, sakta gå hem genom stan. En kyss, sen går man sakta igen, sakta en tur genom stan. Och det är natt och på avstånd och skratt, och man går hem genom stan. En doft av hö från någon djurskärgårdsö smyger sig tyst in till stan. Precis som din arm, så lätt och så arm, känns sommarens vind mot min kin. Och natten står still, den finns inte till, en tystnadens skugga, en vind. Den är så kort och den glider tyst bort när trastarna vaknar i stan. Klockan är två, hela himlen är blå, sakta vi går genom stan. Sakta hit och tror en man i en båt,
stannar och ser på en svan. Allt är tyst och jag tiger nyss kysst. Sakta vi går genom stan. På Västerbron i den himmelska ron, en spårvagn går ensam och tom. Alla hus målar natten i ljus, hemligt går träden i blom. Här bor en miljon, säg hör de den ton som Stockholm nu spelar för dem. De far härifrån, långt bort härifrån, men Stockholm det är ju vårt hem. Vart vi än går vet jag Stockholm är vår, när vi går hem genom stan. Här går vi med en tyst melodi, ensamma i hela stan. Så stannar vi till fåglarnas drill, vi känner en doft av jul. Och glada vi hör en jublande kör, då stiger en gnistrande sol. Åh, det är skönt när mitt Stockholm är grönt. Sakta en natt då i stan, en kyss, sen börjar vandra igen. Sakta gå hem genom stan, sakta gå hem genom stan, sakta gå hem genom stan.
I'm happy to have received a letter from a new listener, somewhere in America, named David Medrick. David was pretty excited when he wrote his letter, apparently happy once again to hear a radio broadcast from Sweden. David tells VSI that he's been tuned into the world on shortwave ever since the 80s. Furthermore, David once worked at JCPenney along with a co-worker who hailed from Gothenburg, Sweden. And if you're listening, David, the correct pronunciation of your friend's name was Patrik Sjölund. David tells us that he would impress his international friends and co-workers with his vast knowledge of the world he gained listening to shortwave radio, frequently tuning in to Radio Sweden, as well as Radio Finland and Radio Norway, that he even picked up a few phrases in these and other languages. Now, on one of Radio Sweden's final English language shortwave broadcasts, they played a song which David really liked in particular. David, you were close. It's not called Bureau Club, but Bureau Club. You really liked that song. I should mention, David is the first one to write to VSI with a music request, which I find exciting. David, I do know which song you mean. Here on VSI, I play a very eclectic range of music in various styles, genres, periods of music history, and in different languages. However, there are certain aesthetic criteria that must be met in order to qualify for play during the program. Now, since you did send such a kind letter and seemed really to enjoy listening in to Sweden once more, I was prepared to stretch the rules a bit, but I just had another listen to Björö Club, and I'm afraid I simply cannot play that song on this program. Still, I won't leave you empty-handed. The singer of Björö Club is a young Swedish woman born in Iran named Lala Purkari. I found another song by her that I can play with you without stretching the aesthetic rules too badly, for which I'll play for you now. This is Lala and her dreadful English singing Some Die Young.
I will tell you a story if you die. I will tell your story and keep you alive the best I can. I will tell them to the children if we have some, if we have some. But I've always felt the feeling we would die young. Some die young. Some you better hold on. So many things I need to say to you.
Finally, just as an announcement about the program itself, those who have been counting will realize that this is the 12th and final episode for VSI this summer. VSI has always been a summertime feature only on WBCQ, and now the summer's over. So thank you to all listeners, old and new, for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed listening. Now, on the other hand, I've just made arrangements with WBCQ to have an autumn season as well that will follow immediately. So, in essence, Season 3 of VSI Radio International begins next Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern, or 1 a.m. Central European Time, and is scheduled to continue each Wednesday between the 18th of September and the 4th of December, inclusively. I have had a few requests to replay the two-part documentary on Radio Nord sometime in the autumn, as many more people will likely be able to hear it. That will likely happen sometime toward the end of the autumn season, so I hope you will continue to tune in to VSI Radio International. And please do continue to send feedback, even if it's just a quick check, to let me know where you're listening. It's interesting to get a picture of just how well the show is getting out. So a big thank you goes out once more to Fred in Ottawa, David Owen Sherbrooke, Jim Tyner in New York, Ramsey in Indiana, Michael Tanivaugh in Massachusetts, Michael in Ohio, Jeb Stevos in the Netherworld, Lou Johnson in Atlanta, Paul Whitmer from somewhere in the United States, and David Medrick, of course. Thank you all for having written in over the summer. One more thing. David Medrick, if you're still listening, I've changed my mind. I'm going to play your song, but it will be immediately after the show ends and Gloria Victoria is done playing. So tonight's finale will be Bureau Club by Lala Pulkarin. Take care. Oh!
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.